Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is novelist, poet, and essayist Margaret Atwood. She's joined in conversation by Holly Furfer. And now join Holly Furfer as she introduces Margaret Atwood.
So on behalf of the Marcus JCC in Atlanta, the National JCC Literary Consortium, and our presenting sponsor, Scribd, I'm pleased to welcome you to a very special evening with Miss Margaret Atwood. We're going to talk about her new Scribd original story, Two Scorched Men, a short work of fiction that draws from characters and places in Ms. Atwood's own life. Two Scorched Men is a semi-autobiographical tale about the author's time in Provence. At its center is a friendship between two very different and eccentric men whose lives were transformed by World War II and by personal tragedy. It's available exclusively on Scribd. Margaret Atwood, whose work has been published in more than 45 countries, is the author of more than 50 books of fiction, poetry, critical essays, and graphic novels. Dearly, her first collection of poetry in over a decade was published November 2020. Her latest novel, The Testaments, is co-winner of the 2019 Booker Prize. It's the long-awaited sequel to The Handmaid's Tale, which is now an award-winning TV series. Her other works of fiction include Cat's Eyes, finalist for the 1989 Booker Prize, Alias Grace, which won the Giller Prize in Canada and the Premio Mondello in Italy, The Blind Assassin, winner of the 2000 Booker Prize, The Madam Trilogy, and Hagseed. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including the Peace Prize of the German Book Trade, the Franz Kafka International Literary Prize, the Penn Center USA Lifetime Achievement Award, and the Los Angeles Times Innovators Award. She lives in Toronto and is still writing, and we are so thankful and honored to have her here. Please welcome Ms. Margaret Atwood to our virtual stage. Welcome. How are you?
I'm very well.
Thank you. I just have to tell you right off the bat, it is such an honor to talk with you. And thank you for still doing such incredible work. Tell us about Two Scorched Men for those who haven't had a chance to read it yet.
Well, it does take place in Provence, where we were for some time. And it does concern two different men, both of whom went through the Second World War in different ways. And one of them is very negative about everybody except this other man. So it's about them, but it's also about them in relation to us when we were there. So we can go on from there. One of the men is Irish, or was Irish, and was in the Royal Navy in the Pacific. Not a happy experience. And the other one, who's French, was in the French resistance in the south of France and had to escape to Spain because they found him out. So it's that time that they are remembering, and which probably damaged them both in those kinds of ways that one gets damaged in wartime. And that's why it's called Two Scorched Men.
How did you meet them in your travels?
Well, we rented a house for one of them. So the ranting Irishman, we rented his house, and he used to come down and stay in it, and just to make sure we were getting on, but really just to hang out and disapprove of things. And the other one, the French one, lived in the town and was his best friend. So he would disparage everybody except Francois. And Francois had infinite tolerance for him.
It seemed that the two of them, though, both John and Francois, took a liking to you and Tig, that they really did, that you were dear to them.
Well, we were their audience. To a certain extent, I think. Yes, they were very We used to have them to dinner together, and it was very interesting to watch them interact. But it goes on from there. So of course, neither of them is alive anymore. This was all going on back in the 90s, and you can count backwards and figure out how old they must have been in the war. They're quite young, but now it's 2021, so they could not possibly still be alive.
What prompted you to write this story now in 2021?
Well, I think they deserved to have their stories told. If there was a reason why they told us, surely. So I thought their lives were very interesting, and I also thought their reactions to their lives were very interesting. And as time goes on, there are fewer and fewer people left who actually went through that time. And they went through it in quite different ways, but so did everyone. I've now known and several different people who were in resistance movements. So one of them was from Poland, who said a very pertinent thing: pray that you will never have the opportunity to be a hero.
In the time that you lived in East Berlin, is what I understand, that where you met them.
West Berlin. No, the Polish resistance person. No, I met that person in France as well, and I met a couple people from the French resistance, and then in Holland, where we also used to go, because Graham's father was a general in the Canadian Army, and they liberated Holland, as you know. We met people who had been in the Dutch resistance, which was pretty tough because, again, a lot of their friends had been killed.
And when you had met them and heard their stories, and you carry them through to 2020, 2021, especially talking about John and Francois, why did you feel it was important to put this down on paper? Why was it important to write the story of their experience?
That's a question that people often ask writers, but there isn't an answer. It is the story that came at that time. So I had been, of course, writing about resistance movements because I'd written the Testaments, and that is about a fictional resistance movement in the country of Gilead. But of course, it drew upon my knowledge of real resistance movements and why do people do that? You know, why do people get involved? You're putting your life in danger. It's frequently young people. So I put two young people in the Testaments. And I also got very interested in not only why people do, but also why people don't. So these things are of great interest to me. And as the Trump presidency moved along, and got closer and closer to being an autocracy, resistance movements became of more and more interest to me, and also collaborationists, like why do people collaborate?
When these two characters in Two Scorched Men, how do they form that bond? I mean, one is, like you said, Irish, one is French. How do they find each other, and what connects them to be so close?
Okay, so I don't know how they met, because that happened before I knew them, but why they were close was quite evidently partly because both of them had been through something that other people around them had not. So they understood each other at that level. They didn't have to explain themselves, as it were, in that respect. So I think that was it. They both were of a certain age. They both had been through that time period. They both had been involved in it, and therefore here they were, two very, very different people, very, very different views of life. One with an explosive temper, the other with a very ironic, humorous approach. But they were best friends.
One of the things that stuck out to me in the story is you tell the story, I believe it was Francois who would do this sort of theater talk a little bit about the theater, because it was very interesting.
Okay, so after the war had ended, in the basically late 50s and early 60s, Paris was a hotbed of not only intellectual pursuits such as existentialism, it was the heyday of Albert Camus and Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and UNESCO, but it was also an epicenter of experimental theater. So you were getting a lot of experimental plays happening, and François was actually part of that. Whether the plays that I describe, which he described, were ever put on or not, I couldn't tell you, but it may just have been his ironic joke about what you could make into a play. So one of his plays was a rocking chair that the curtain opens and the rocking chair is rocking very fast, and then it rocks slower and slower and slower, and then it stops. And the other one was a cockroach walking up a wall across the ceiling and down the other side of the wall. So I said, François, those plays must have been very short. He said, oh, yes, they were very short.
And it's funny, though, because the reaction, you were very, both you and Tig were very gracious about not, but you kind of saw it as theater of the absurd, didn't you?
Well, it was theater of the absurd. That was the point. It was supposed to be absurd.
And you didn't call him out. You didn't mention that. But
what was to call out? We all knew it. We all knew all those plays. Remember how old I am. So what was being performed in colleges all over the place in the late 50s and early 60s? It was Samuel Beckett. Again, theater of the absurd. And UNESCO. We saw a lot of that. So we all knew the ambience, the surround. We knew the scene.
And why this is it's 37 pages. So why a short story on the two of them? Did you ever think about making it a longer story?
No, a story is as long as the material. So you couldn't make it longer. You also couldn't make it shorter. It is as long as it is. 37 pages, maybe with big type.
On my copy, it was 37 pages, and I loved every minute of it. And talk a little bit about, you did, and you mentioned earlier how, you know, the generation, the World War II generation, those who actually fought in World War II, they're all gone. We're even losing some of the children of that, and why it's important to memorialize that in writing and in stories and fiction and nonfiction.
Well, it's an event that determined the rest of the 20th century and is still determining events today. So if you start with the First World War, which determined the Second, that whole period, and I have to say that nothing has felt so much like the 30s as the recent polarization in the United States. So I'm very interested in that period, of course. I was born in 1939, so it's amazing to reflect that I was alive during the whole of that war, except for the first 2 months.
Wow.
But I was, of course, a child, but the whole 40s was wartime, and it didn't stop being that in 46. We still had rationing in Canada until basically the 1950, and the fashions, the preoccupations, all of that remained. I remember Life magazine, which was a big thing in those days, the new look. You don't remember that because you're too young, but the new look was when poofy dresses came in again. So that, you remember 50s pictures of strapless evening gowns, the poofy dress, the crinolines, all of that came in 1950, which was supposed to signal, okay, we don't have to wear those boxy clothes anymore. We don't have to wear that dark clothing anymore. We can now have pink again. We can have tulle. We can have evening gowns that are poofy. So the silhouette changed, the materials changed, the attitude changed. And what else came in? Technicolor film for everybody and plastics.
Plastic.
No.
But it sounds interesting. So going through, having seen that as a young person and then hearing the stories that John and Francois had told you over the years, How did it form your thoughts, especially to me as a poet, as a writer, as a storyteller?
Well, it's just, you know, you come from where you come from, and the time that you, your formative time, what the French call formation, and they also distinguish, which is very useful, your early childhood, which is petite enfance, and then your later childhood. And that would be very useful to have in the English language, because people are always saying, tell me about your childhood. And I have to say, which part? You're very different at the age of five from what you are at the age of 10. But certainly when I look at I have an older brother who's about 3 years older. When I look at his childhood writings and scrapbooks, they're all about war. So much so that he traded colored pencils with me. I got his pink, gold, and silver, so useful for princesses. And he got my red, orange, and yellow, so useful for flames.
Hey, you guys worked well together.
Apparently, yeah. So Francois really did escape to Spain, and he did get put in a camp for aliens. And he did eat all of these sardines, which he said, I cannot look a sardine in the eye. And he did get traded by the British. The British traded him. So he went to London, and he said, they traded me for a sack of flour. And he said, but it was a very big sack. So then he was working with de Gaulle, who at that point had just a minuscule operation. And he really was tracking trains around France. And there really was a guillotine on one of them that was supposed to be sent to a city to execute somebody, and it never got there. The train kept being rerouted. It kept being, you know, sent somewhere else because possibly, and this really happened on D-Day, a lot of the train conductors, the people driving the trains, were in the resistance. And when the call came to let's snarl up the train so they don't get to Normandy, they did it. And then a bunch of them got shot. So it was it's a very intense period of time. And Graham, having been in the army, and his dad having been a Canadian general, of course we had to go to Normandy. I think I've been there three times to see the landing beaches. And we went to the American landing beaches too, which are very, very hazardous, more hazardous than the ones further north, because they have big cliffs overlooking them. And the Americans had a terrible time landing until some Marines shimmied up the cliff and took out the guns. I think one of my favorite stories of that region is Pegasus Bridge. Do you want to hear it?
Yes, please.
Okay. So Pegasus Bridge was a bridge that they had to take, because otherwise they would have been bottled up on the beach. So they had to take the bridge in order to get across and get up into Holland and Germany. So the night before D-Day, they took six gliders, wide gliders, because they're silent. And three of them aimed for Pegasus Bridge, and two of them landed basically within baseball heave distance of the bridge, silently at night. And then the backs opened and out came the soldiers and they took the bridge. Surprise.
Wow.
And they held it until Lord Lovett and his commandos rode up the next day at noon, having landed on the beach on bicycles. Why were they bicycles? Because they knew the roads would all be bombed, which they had been. So they rode up on their bicycles. He reinforced the people holding the bridge. Lord Lovett, being Scottish, had a bagpiper with him. Always you have a bagpiper. So he said to his bagpiper, why don't you just stroll across the bridge and give the lads a tune?
In the middle of a war, here comes a bagpiper across the bridge.
So the bagpiper does. He walks across playing the bagpipes and he walks back playing the bagpipes. And the Germans were so astonished that they didn't shoot him.
It's amazing. Yeah, of course. Like you said, you always bring a bagpiper with you. I mean, I'm surprised that we don't bring a guitar player, you know, the Americans. That's
not loud enough.
Amazing. That's right.
If you had somebody playing the bagpipes practicing near you, you know how extremely loud that is. So it's a very carrying sound. And after the Bonnie Prince Charlie fiasco, the British banned the bagpipe as an instrument of war.
You're listening to novelist, poet, and essayist Margaret Atwood, whose latest work of fiction is Two Scorched Men. She's joined in conversation by Holly Furfer on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kaalw.org.
When you hear these stories, and you hear the stories like the Two Scorched Men, John and Francois, you hear their stories, even though those are somewhat, you know, semi-autobiographical, semi-nonfiction, does it prompt in your mind, how is your process where you think these would be great to start a fiction or to write fiction off of something like that once you get some details, some real details, true details?
Well, you know, I think the word in Italian is the same for both. Historia. It's the same thing. So we distinguish fiction, nonfiction, but they're all stories. So you can say fictionalized, which simply means we could have put in a lot more realistic detail, but we didn't because we're forming it into a story. So you know, with The Handmaid's Tale, I refused to put anything into it that did not have a precedent in real life. And the reason for that was simply I didn't want people saying, as they did, that then did say, why did you make up such weird I didn't make it up. You know, this happened here, that happened there. This is what these people did. That's what those people did. So there's a precedent for everything. And that probably comes from having been brought up by the scientists and being picky about those things.
And sometimes reality is stranger than fiction, right? Don't they say
that? It's stranger, and it's way more violent. I mean, if you wrote it all down and actually put it in a book, it would probably be fairly unreadable because it would be too horrifying.
What is your process for writing? I mean, you've written so much, from poetry, short stories, novels. How is it, do you keep like a notebook, and then when you have ideas, or how do you continually just keep moving forward on this process when a lot of people would say, I'm going to slow down?
Why would they say that? So they might say, I've run out, or they might say, that's enough of that. Or they might say, I'm getting a lot worse. You know, we say about writers, they never retire. But sometimes they just get worse. late Tennyson, you will know what I mean. So what I want is a best friend. You know, those ads that used to say, even your best friend won't tell you. I want my best friend who will tell me, you're actually getting quite a lot worse, you better stop. But I probably wouldn't stop. I probably just wouldn't publish. Who knows? Who knows? I'm still, but process. So I never went to writing school, so I never knew that I had to have a process. However, I can make something up for you if you would like.
Yeah. You would, like, how do you all of a sudden just think, huh, you get an idea and then things just flow? Or no. Is it?
Here's the magic implement. It's called a pen.
Uh-huh.
Magic.
We don't use enough of them anymore, let me tell you.
But I never learned to type properly, I do use a pen. So I think I picture it like a rat running a maze in search of cheese. So you head off down the tunnel, you turn to the left, no cheese there. You come back out, you go further along, you turn to the right, no cheese there. You keep on going, you turn to the left, cheese. So you try things out, And if they don't work, you either throw them out if they're really bad, or you put them in your maybe this will work later drawer, which in my case is right over there. That's my maybe it will work later drawer. And sometimes it does work later and sometimes it doesn't. But of course, there may be another later.
Do you get inspired by real life events, some things that you hear? I mean, I, from what I understand, Handmaid's Tale came from a lot of clippings and topics and things that you were seeing in the news, and you had gathered that together.
I did that. So my Alice in Wonderland part of the process is write first, research later.
Really?
If you research too much first, you're going to bog it down with all your research, which of course is all fascinating and you want to put all of it in, but it doesn't all fit in. So what you have to keep in mind is always the reader, and does the reader really need to have the story stop right here for your little disquisition on Victorian underwear, in which you're, of course, you're very fascinated. And if you are fascinated by it too, I refer you to a YouTube series called Prior Attire, in which she is an historical costume maker, and she shows you how to put the stuff on, including what went on underneath to make it the shape that it is.
It's amazing that we need direction on how to put on some clothes, but that's it. How do you find these things? We talked earlier about you finding some random, are you just, you know, fascinated? It seems to me like you're constantly taking input.
Well, I had a grandmother who had an attic, and in it were all sorts of things. And that's what the inside of my head is like. It's like my grandmother's attic. And you never know when you might need that thing that you have put in the attic. So so it is a pack rat sort of mentality. You have these things, you've got them in the attic. And then when you need one of them, you think, I think I remember putting that in the attic. Let me just go and see. Yes,
I love it.
It's a dress form from 1910. It's just what I needed.
That I found 6 years ago or so that I remember. What do you have words of advice for those, for the younger generation, the younger writers, poets, storytellers, who don't have the years and years of input and knowledge and that attic, like you mentioned, how to sort of pick up your torch and move on and run with it?
Oh, a lot of them are just in full flight right now. So I don't think you need to worry about that. Storytelling is a very human thing, and there are always going to be people doing it in one form or another, whether it is in writing or whether it's in television, whether it's in film, whether it's on new platforms. And I thought Scribd was pretty good, you know, but apparently it's Scribd. So Scribd for Scribble. Scribd would be for inscribed. But take your choice. But my main thing is to those young people who are hesitant and possibly worried and anxious, nobody sees it until you decide they can. So it's you and the page. And if you then decide this isn't something you want to make public, you can discard it. So there's nobody looking over your shoulder while you're writing, although you may think there is.
And I want to ask you, because to that effect about the Future Library, I thought that was fascinating that you contributed to. Would you tell us about the Future Library?
Okay, so the Future Library Norway is a slow time project. And it was the brainchild of a Scottish conceptual artist called Katie Patterson. And the idea is that they planted a forest north of Oslo, which will grow for 100 years. You can see this has a Sleeping Beauty kind of leitmotif going on. It will grow for 100 years. And in each year of that 100 years, a different author from around the world, all different languages, all different cultures, will be asked to contribute a manuscript to the Future Library of Norway. And there are two stipulations. Number one, it has to be in words, just words, no images, no putting your photo album in. So just words. But of those words, You can have it. You can have anything. It can be a laundry list. It can be a single word. It can be a short story. It can be a novel. It can be a play. It can be a letter. It can be a journal entry. It can be, you name it, a piece of history, anything made of words. And the second stipulation is you can't tell what it is. So secret manuscript, made of words, you can tell the title, and they hope that it will be about time and words, they hope. But again, they will not know either. And you make two copies only, two paper copies, and then as backup, two digital copies, which of course they're going to have to keep changing as the tech changes. And those are stored away in the Future Library of Norway, which exists now in Oslo. You can go into the room, you can see the names of the authors and the titles of what they have written, and that's all you can say. And see, and Katie Patterson says, standing in the room and imagining what might be there as part of the conceptual art. So that goes on for 100 years. In the 100th year, which will be 2114, all of the boxes are opened. The trees are cut to make the paper on which the anthology of the Future Library of Norway will be printed. And right now you can buy a certificate entitling you to a copy of it in 2014. And just to make sure, if you put a printing press in, and just to make absolutely sure, if the language is a small one, she puts a dictionary in case the language has gone extinct.
Wow.
So she thought of everything. And we launched it in 2014. I took my box. I put a blue ribbon on it. I went to Norway. I was afraid they would say, what's in the box? And I would have to tell you, and then they would arrest me. That didn't happen. And went to Oslo, took my box. We all strolled into the forest in a light drizzle, as there would be. And there were these little trees. They had put ribbons on them so we wouldn't step on them. The forester made a speech. The mayor of Oslo made a speech. The librarian made a speech. Katie Patterson made a speech. I made a speech, and I handed over the box. Wow. And that's what every author does. So I think they're up to now 7 or so. Well, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. It's now 8. So the next one will be 9. And they have a committee that rolls over every 5 years that invites the authors. Not everybody's going to want to do this. I say, are you crazy? Why would I write something that nobody can see for 100 years?
But it's amazing because you think forward to the generation that will see that. And in 100 years, think about when we look back 100 years, the questions we have or how much we see. Does it make you think, you know, how different things may be? And they'll think, well, what was she thinking? Or is it, I'm fascinated by that, to show what life was like in 2014, 2017, 2021, 2035.
Well, when I tell people writing their journals that maybe somebody's going to be reading their journals 70, 80, 90 years from now, I say, describe the things that you think everybody knows about. Because in 80 years, it's the commonplace things that they will have forgotten, and that people often don't put into novels because they think everybody knows them. So what's a toaster?
Right. What's a dial phone? Like, kids today don't know. One of my friend's daughters, who is 11, asked, why do you say dial the number?
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Why do you say dial the number? Why do you say phone?
Exactly. I do want to talk, because everybody, I mean, Handmaid's Tale is just everything. You wrote that, you know, 40 years ago? 40 years ago now? I can't imagine that we're all that 50 years ago. Wow.
1984, very cornily, it being the title of a famous Orwell novel.
That's right.
Yes, I did start it in West Berlin when the wall was still up. And at that time, I did visit East Berlin and also Czechoslovakia and also Poland, which were all still behind the Iron Curtain. And that was very instructive. So yes, that's when I was writing it as 84.5, and I started thinking about it in 81.
Wow. Does it surprise you that 50 years later, it has the resurgence that it has in not only the novel, but when you look at what prompted this also to become sort of the topic of the time, what was happening in our country?
Okay, so I have never believed anyone who says it can't happen here, because anything can happen anywhere given the circumstances. And, you know, it's drowsy to say it can't happen here, but people were saying that quite a bit at that time. And remember what was going on in the world, as long as that Iron Curtain was still there, the United States was a beacon of light, liberty, democracy, freedom. That's how people in the rest of the world saw it. And however, we had had a very tumultuous 60s, and then we had had a 70s, especially for women, in which a lot of rights were gained. So guess what? You can have your own credit card account. Lucky you.
Yeah.
You could get a mortgage all by yourself now, which you couldn't have at the beginning of that period.
Crazy.
Et cetera. So a lot of, you know, rights, divorce rights, et cetera, reproductive rights, all of those were fought for in those years. And then there was pushback in the 80s. So Reagan gets elected, mourning in America, well, maybe for some people. And everything started changing. So social safety nets got taken away. Rights started being rolled back. There's pushback. And the rise of the religious right as a political force took place then. So what I was doing partly was just looking at what some people were saying they would like to do if they got the power, and thinking, well, how would you do that? So how would you make it so that women had to be in the home? How would you make it so? Well, you would take away their money, and you would take away their autonomy. You would make it so that they couldn't have jobs. And where else would they be but in the home, or hoovering up atomic waste in a concentration camp of some kind, or forced labor camp? So that's what you would do. And then you would, of course, make it impossible for them to travel, so they couldn't get out.
Does it sort of, I mean, does it, when you look at what the resurgence and when it happened again, and when you look at that and you think, wow, I really thought we may have been able to put that away in the 80s, 90s, we hadn't come so far. And then you have women in women's marches say, I'm still holding this damn sign all these years later. You know, does it make you think, hey, I'm glad that this is here so that it could resurface for those who may not have read it in the 90s or the early 2000s, but now, you know, it's sort of a guide, like, hey, it's a warning sign, but it also is a disheartening to know that we need to read this again to be reminded of what really could happen.
You know, history is not a straight line. No matter what anybody has told you, it does not proceed along the yellow brick road to the Emerald City of Oz. Inevitably, there is no inevitability about it. So you see, you can see societies change very, very, very quickly. And we saw that in the 30s. So sometimes they're the result of revolutions, but sometimes they're the result of people voting. So you vote in a group of people who are essentially against voting. And guess what they do then? They rearrange the election laws.
They find a way.
Against democracy, and would rather have an oligarchy, or would rather have an autocracy, rearrange the laws so that only they will ever be elected. That's what they do.
I have one last question before we get to viewers, some of our guests here that have questions for you. But the Testaments, you wrote that it's the sequel to The Handmaid's Tale. It was 2019. It explains a lot in The Handmaid's Tale as well. Was that prompted from the resurgence of The Handmaid's Tale, or was that something you had always had the idea that you might go back and revisit it?
No, I never had the idea. But the political landscape changed. You may remember that.
Yeah.
It changed the run up to the Trump election, which was 2016. So I started writing it before that election, which is also when we were shooting the first season of The Handmaid's Tale, in which I have a somewhat notorious cameo. So I started writing it then, and I continued writing it through 2017 and 18. So it came from a change in the political landscape, as The Handmaid's Tale did itself.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is novelist, poet, and essayist Margaret Atwood, whose latest work of fiction is Two Scorched Men. She's joined in conversation by Holly Furfer. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I do want to get to some of our guest questions. So let me bring on Nancy Sims first. Nancy, if you will join us.
John and Francois seem to bond because of their respective war experiences. Do you think male friendships are different than female friendships?
If you'd like to see female friendships, women bonding as a result of war experiences, there are a lot of those. And one interesting thing to research would be the Night Witches. The Night Witches were a squadron of female pilots in the Russian army. And they were given sort of tacky planes made of plywood. But there was an advantage to that because they didn't show up on radar. So the Night Witches were able to fly under the radar, go in and bomb their targets, and very silently, and they would do it at night. And it was the Germans who gave them the name Night Witches, because they would appear out of nowhere and swoop in their little plywood airplanes. And they were ferociously brave. So you can find an article on them on Wikipedia, the Night Witches. But but a lot of them, you'll have women bonding with women who went through those things, but also women bonding with men who also went through those things. So people who worked in resistance movements together, for instance. We're learning a lot more about women in those movements now than we did, say, in the 60s, 70s. Fascinating stories. There was a very famous American female resistance person who had only one leg, and why they never caught her, I don't know. You know, she was, you'd think that would be easy to spot. But another person who was in the resistance was Josephine Baker, dancer. She was in it. And she said quite famously, "Well, they're not going to search me," which they didn't.
And we know the history of Julia Child as well, which is another one that was a shocker to many of us.
Yes. Well, so a lot of people took vows of silence, so they never really talked about what they had been doing. But I knew somebody in the British, on the British side, who was dropped behind French lines, and his job was to interrogate any pilot that they were rescuing, because these British pilots would be passed along an underground line. And sometimes German agents who had gone to Oxford or Cambridge, had perfect accents, would be run through to expose them, to expose the network. And he had to question them and have conversations with them to figure out whether they were real or not.
Wow.
And he was 19. I mean, I think he...
The pressure.
Yeah. He became a forensic psychiatrist.
That makes a lot of sense. That would definitely set your career path off. Thank you so much, Nancy. It was a great question.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here and speaking. Thank you.
And now we have Lev Rothenberg from the Indianapolis JCC. Hi, Lev. Welcome. What's your question for Ms. Atwood?
Thank you. Margaret, so much of your writing has to do with visions of dystopian future. Do you feel that we're living in dystopian times? And also, do you feel that our future is likely to be dystopian?
All right. You know what Charles Dickens said? It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And that is true right now. So it is the best of times for some people and the worst of times for other people. And the second part of the answer is there is no the future. There are an infinite number of possible futures, and none of them is inevitable. So you can change the future we get by changing what you're doing in the present. And it's not sort of written in stone that we have to have this future or that future. So when people ask me that question, I always say, well, we have a possible dystopian future, and here's how you would get there. And we also have, and we have a number of bad ones. They could take various forms. And we also have some good ones. And here are the good ones. And here's how you would, what you would have to do to get there. The difficulty with writing utopias, which were poured out in huge numbers in the 19th century because people did see things getting better. And all of these inventions like railway engines and hot air balloons and sewage systems and vaccines all came from the 19th century. So they didn't see why things couldn't just get a whole lot more better. And they wrote a lot of utopias. The difficulty with them is that they're often quite boring as literature. That is the difficulty. Because as you know, in a story, there has to be suspense. But if you're living in a perfect world, where's the suspense? So a lot of them have a traveler from the present who ends up in the future in some improbable way and then gets it all explained to him. So they're quite didactic.
That's a really good point.
Interesting utopia. So it's a problem.
Thank you. That was very, very thought-provoking.
Thank you, Lev. Great question. We appreciate you. I do have some written questions here, too, that I have. And one of them is from Stacey Freed from the Rochester JCC. And she wants to know, how did you spend your time during the pandemic? Was lockdown a good time for you to write, or was it the opposite for you?
Well, apart from the 300 Zooms, what else do writers do except stay in a room by themselves and talk to people who aren't there?
This just fit right into your narrative your whole life.
Well, yeah. My whole life is a form of lockdown. I did write a book once about what it is that writers think they're doing and who do they think they are. And it was originally called Negotiating with the Dead, but the publishers didn't like the D word. I don't know why. So they changed it to A Writer on Writing.
Oh.
And in it, I talk about the fact that every writer has a double personality. So there's the person who walks the dog, cooks the omelet, makes chit-chat with the family, and then there's the other one. So it's the other one who writes the books. You can never actually talk to the other one. I'm just a surrogate. So you can't talk to the other one because the other one is writing, and there's always a gap between the time that you're writing and the time that somebody reads it. Mm-hmm. So you can't talk to the person who wrote the testaments. I can pretend to be that person.
but you're not that person now. It's
no.
In the moment.
Time has passed. So that's unlike the art of, for instance, performance opera singer. So if that person makes a mistake, we all hear it because we're in the theater.
So it, using your example, an opera singer may make a mistake and that moment is lived and then it's gone. But in your books and the written word, whether it's not a mistake, something on purpose, but your words live on forever.
Well, there is no forever, but, or, you know, read literature that was written 500 years ago. And good luck understanding some of it. So language keeps changing, as we know, and books keep going in and out of fashion. But let's say it lives for a while.
For a while. Well, our forever, my forever.
Yes. Well, that's very nice of you. You may get sick of it pretty soon.
Here's another. I've
been there, done that. I'm reading something else now. So it does have that quality, and I talk about that in the book on writing. So it has that quality of seeming permanent. Mm-hmm. So ancient cultures used to engrave things on stone. But then, of course, another regime would come in and they would go and chisel all the noses off the statues of the previous people and rub out their stone inscriptions.
And you rely on the memories of the people who saw it, and they can tell the tale. So it's written later.
Yeah, sure. It morphs. You know, you played broken telephone as a child at birthday parties, no doubt. So stories do get changed in the telling, unless the person has a very good memory, which is how a lot of oral poetry got transmitted, by people with very good memories. They memorize the whole thing. So yes, it's always a problem. What is the form? I went to university just up the road from Marshall McLuhan when he was first publishing. So I'm very conscious of the medium and what influence it has on the message. And writing is a particular kind of medium, and it has certain properties. And so does the Codex book. So when writing was in scrolls and not stuffed into a book with a spine and pages, it was a lot less linear, because you could have this scroll or you could have that scroll. And that, of course, was the Torah originally, and the Bible was put together into a Codex book. And as soon as you do that, you have to have a beginning and an end.
Yeah.
Because the Codex book is linear. Why we have, you know, the end. We have a novel. They begin here and then they go through to the end.
But which is why we like the idea of a sequel, because maybe the end is not the end.
Well, the end is never the end in real life. There are endings, but there is not the end. So Elizabeth marries Mr. Darcy. Then what?
it happens up here, and we hope that maybe someone else will write it for us so we can read it. But I think that's, I love though that you did. That's why I was fascinated and loved the testaments, because there was no end, and there really isn't an end to The Handmaid's Tale, which made me so happy because it's so brilliant that there was a sequel, and that's
ended. Yeah. So people ask me for years, what happens? And I would say, well, I don't know. You know, on Monday, I think she gets caught. And on Wednesday, I think she gets away. And up to you.
I love that. Let me get one more question in before we have to end. And Howard Fagan asks, who are a few of the books that have been an impact on you as an author?
Well, now, I think you get your idea of what books are and what stories are quite early in life. So how early would you like to start?
What's your earliest book memory that really stuck with you? That made you feel something?
The Prose Style of Beatrix Potter, author of Peter Rabbit, but even more influentially, the author of The Tale of Mr. Todd. So if you study the text, you realize that she's quite elliptical, quite oblique in her way of telling. So we could start with her, Jemima Puddle Duck, a stupid character, but the reader figures out what's going on. The child reader, age five, figures out what's going on.
Or at least you, as the child reader, figured out. I don't know if this child reader at five would figure it out, but...
Well, you're not five anymore. Of course you would. So then on through various classics, but I was a big sci-fi and speculative fiction reader in my teens, as a lot of teens are. And it was, I was the age to read 1984 when it came out in paperback. I still have the lurid early 50s copy of that with a 50s style cover on it.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very attractive woman with somebody leering at her.
And you're right, those are very influential. I'm glad that those books, like The Handmaid's Tale, stand the test of time, that we will be reading them, hopefully, into the future.
Well, if you're allowed to read, of course, should that.
Oh, right. You're now we're getting into Fahrenheit 451 and we're opening a whole can of worms.
Yeah, which I also read as a teenager. It was quite shocking to me. But there are, again, real life examples of books surviving because people memorized them.
Right, right. And look at, and to bring it back into the Two Scorched Men, you talk about what happened in World War II and could it be repeated? You know, they burned the books. They burned a lot of books that they didn't want people to read.
That has not stopped. It's moved around its locations in the world, but it has not stopped. And any tyranny worth its salt is going to burn books because they want to get rid of any countervailing narrative.
Well, we're running out of time, so I just wanted to say thank you so much for being here, for talking to us all. It has been an honor. We look forward to whatever you write in the future, and I wish I was around for 2114 to see what you wrote in the future library. We'll have to leave it to the great-great-great-grandkids.
Well, you never know, Holly.
That's right. Fingers crossed. Maybe we'll figure it out. But thank you so much, Miss Atwood. We appreciate you so much, and we look forward to The Two Scorched Men and everything else that's after. And thank you, everybody, for being here. Stay safe, stay happy, and stay tuned. We'll see you soon.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was novelist, poet, and essayist Margaret Atwood, whose latest work of fiction is Two Scorched Men. She was joined in conversation by Holly Furfer. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamatuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.